Agricultural State of Hawaii is now reconvened.
Please call the case.
Case number SCWC-12-588, State v. Yang. Arguing for the petitioner, Phyllis J. Hironaka. Arguing for respondent, Brian R. Vincent. Argument on the merits.
All right. Good morning, Ms. Hironaka. Mr. Vincent, are you both ready to proceed today?
Yes.
All right. And we will, Ms. Hironaka, you've reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal, so we'll give you a warning at that point in your argument. Mr. Vincent, we will give you a light with 5 minutes to go as well. Please proceed. Thank you.
May it please the court, Deputy Public Defender Phyllis Hironaka, on behalf of Scott Yang, respectfully requests that this honorable court vacate the ICA's SDO summary disposition order, specifically on two grounds raised. Number one, to vacate the conviction in count six and remand it for a new trial with jury instructions which clearly explain the proper application of self-defense. And number two, to vacate and reverse the conviction in count eight because of three reasons. One is insufficient, i.e. insubstantial, evidence that the abuse occurred at the alleged time of the incident. And also, of course, that plays into the trial court's erroneous denial of the motion for judgment of acquittal. Second reason, because of the trial court's erroneous denial of Scott's motion to dismiss for variance from the time noticed by the state in the 12.1 response. And third, because of the trial court's erroneous refusal of Scott's time-specific elements instruction, which destroyed his alibi defense.
I have a question, Ms. Hironaka, a fundamental question. How is this an alibi defense?
The state, well, initially, and I'm going to go to the chronology of this, defense had filed a notice of
our defense. Courts?
Yes.
Hawaii law says an alibi defense does not dispute the evidence that the crime charged was committed in the manner alleged. Rather, it merely challenges the identity of the perpetrator. In the State versus Gabrillo case, that's an ICA case from 1994. And in that case, the ICA noted that the defendant did not challenge the identity of the perpetrator, that someone else had actually committed the crime. Rather, he attempted to show that the complainant was making false accusations. And that's not an alibi defense. There's no issue of identity.
Right.
Of in a spousal abuse case.
Right.
It's either he did it or he didn't. And so I don't understand why this is an alibi defense. It seems to me that if you wanted to know the time, you needed to file a motion for bill of particulars, and then the court would address whether or not the defense is entitled to a bill of particulars. But this is not an alibi defense.
Your Honor, I am not familiar with the, is it Gabrillo or
Gabrillo?
G?
G. 10 Hawaii App 448. And, you know, Professor Bowman in his evidence manual, when he, in a commenting on 40432B, says, if the defendant presents an alibi defense and disputes his identity as a perpetrator, an alibi defense is when you're disputing, you're saying, it's not me, it's somebody else. It's not, they didn't, you know, she's making it up. That's not an alibi defense.
Your Honor, my understanding is that the defense that you were talking about, which is that identity defense, that falls right under the guise of reasonable doubt, which is that this wasn't the guy who did it. We're not disputing that the event or the act occurred and that the, you know, the alleged victim or complainant was injured. But there are many times there are mistaken identity defenses, etc.
How can this be a mistaken identity defense when it's the, you know,
right,
husband?
No, I understand what you're saying there, but I, again, not being completely with the Gabrillo case, and I'm sorry about that. I am wondering if it said the only way that an alibi defense can be upheld is if it's a mistaken identity.
No, it's not a mistaken, it's that I wasn't there.
Well, denial.
It's a denial. It's like, it wasn't me, maybe the crime occurred, but in any event, it wasn't me. I'm not the perpetrator.
Okay.
So this is not an identity defense. This is not saying it wasn't me, somebody else did it, it wasn't me. It's when you're challenging, you know, you're saying that she's making it up, that's not an alibi defense.
Well, also on this specific count, he did deny hitting her, right? He said that he was at the parade, he was doing his special duty. So that is really essentially a denial of committing the offense, that it wasn't me.
And the Gabrillo case specifically talked about the defendant's attempt to elicit testimony disputing the time of day that the incident occurred was an attempt to impeach the complainant and not an attempt to establish an alibi.
Okay.
Well,
Ms.
Hironaki, did the state raise this objection and say, you know, we're not going to respond, this isn't an alibi defense? It actually responded both at the first trial and the second.
Absolutely. And that's part of the point, is the state read it as an alibi. The court didn't seem to have any problem with it as an alibi. It was just the issue of the changing time when it came down to the second trial and the complainant's testimony about what time the offense occurred.
So even if it wasn't technically an alibi defense, might the state, due process concerns nevertheless, restrict the state's ability to offer a theory of the case or evidence that contradicted its pretrial representation?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And in fact, the state was the one that responded to the notice of alibi defense by saying it was on April 7th of 2010 between 6:30 and 7 p.m., and that was based upon all the information that the state had at that time, which included the interview with the complainant, I believe her 252, which was written with the help of, I mean, she was not a fluent English speaker, so it was written with the help of other individuals, but there was no indication to the state that it occurred at any other time but 6:30 to 7 p.m., and so in reliance on that statement, the state proffered its alibi answer, and so the defense went out and prepared its defense that Scott was somewhere else between 6:30 and 7 p.m. And so
the response was around 6:30 or 7. Is that what it said?
6:30 to 7.
But around.
Yes.
Suppose that she had testified that the incident occurred at 6:15. Would that be around or 6 o'clock? I mean, where's the dividing line?
That's a good question, Your Honor. And I would say, I see where the court is going, and that, you know, that's fairly close. But, you know, clearly to say 4 to 5, as in this case, that's way out of bounds. Way out of bounds from the time.
Doesn't it depend? I mean, it seems like what's driving your interpretation is based more on what the defense was able to come up with their witnesses.
Well, the defense witnesses or the defense evidence, first of all, he relied on his work records, that he was working special duty both in the morning and then again in the afternoon. And the afternoon special duty
I'm
started
not contesting.
At 5:30.
No, maybe I wasn't as clear as
I'm sorry.
I apologize. What I meant is that the reason you're saying you were misled is more dependent, it seems to me, or very much dependent, based on the evidence that the defense was able to obtain. That's why it turned out to be misleading to them. In other words, if they hadn't been able to, suppose, for example, exact same scenario, and they hadn't come up with those witnesses, then and the testimony would have been the same.
You mean that the defense hadn't come up with the witnesses?
Yeah, if the defense hadn't come up.
Right, then he would have had a hard time raising his alibi defense, because he wouldn't have any evidence on his side to say that he was elsewhere at the time that the alleged incident occurred. True, that's true. But in this case, the state said our evidence is going to be that it occurred on this date, right around this specific time, 6:30 to 7, and so it led the defense to believe that they should gather witnesses and evidence to show that he was not with her
not present with her at that specific time because they expected, they relied on that evidence coming up.
Understood. Why didn't the defense move for mistrial?
Several reasons, Your Honor. First of all, there had been a previous mistrial in this case, and they were working on a second case. This testimony about the 4 to 5 p.m. came out in the complainant, who was the very first witness's testimony, on her direct. And immediately at the end of her direct, defense counsel tried to remedy the situation by making a motion to dismiss as to all counts, but in particularly as to count 8, as well as counts 2 and 3, based on the alibi and the variance. And what the court did at that time was, instead of responding, it said, I'll take it under advisement, but you are to go ahead and cross-examine her.
I understand that, but my question is different. My question is a mistrial at that point, which I think the defense would have fully been entitled to because there was that variance, and then the great likelihood is there would have been a Moriwaki motion to follow, and the case would have been done.
Possibly, but it was only as to count 8.
Correct.
And so, you know, they had to proceed with counts 1 through 7. There wasn't the same basis for a mistrial as to counts 1 through 7. But I think the other concern was that, the state would be getting yet another bite at the apple. And now...
Oh, I don't mean a mistrial as to all the counts. Just the
just
one
as
count.
To count 8.
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, you only asked to dismiss one count. You didn't ask to dismiss all the counts.
Well, he did, but not on that basis. It was on other bases. But my read of it is that there was a strong, a strong direction from the court that this case is going on. This case is going to continue. And so you are to, proceed to cross-examine the complainant and then proceed to put on your defense witnesses and your defense case.
Well, why would the defendant be limited to the remedy of a mistrial? Why not the jury instruction? Why not hold the government to what it said it was going to prove? Is there any rule that the defendant has to seek a mistrial and then have to go through the burden of trial again because of the government having made a representation and then not following through?
No, Your Honor. There were a number of remedies, and defense tried to use all of those remedies, but unsuccessfully, as the court denied them one by one. So the court, first of all, denied the motion for judgment of acquittal initially at the close of this, sort of the close of the state's case. That they did a thing where there was one more witness to be presented, and so defense counsel made a motion for judgment of acquittal after the last of the state's witnesses, save for that one criminalist, the gun expert. At that time, what the court said is that based on, the evidence in the light most favorable to the prosecution, your motion for a judgment of acquittal is denied. Now, he also raised the variance problem at that time, but the court did not make any ruling. He just said based on the standard for the motion for judgment of acquittal. So that variance issue was still not decided, formally decided. And so then, as we proceed in trial down yet again, when it comes to the settling of the instructions, he proffers the specific time elements instruction that he had filed way back in 2011 before the close of the first trial. He renewed, that was denied, okay? And then after the state officially rested when the criminalist had testified, he renewed again the motion for judgment of acquittal and incorporated in the variance and all other arguments that he had made. And the court said very succinctly and tersely denied. And then came the state's closing, where the prosecutor very candidly argued to the jury that we agree that we have not established count 8. So it's not been proven beyond a reasonable doubt, and he should not be guilty of that. I mean, to me, that's clear that at that point in time, the court should have stepped in and granted the motion for the variance or the motion for judgment of acquittal, any of the different remedies that defense counsel had proposed. But it did not do that. We only get a ruling, a clear ruling on the motion for variance post-verdict. which is basically too late. So on March 9 of 2012, after the verdicts had been read, after the jury has been polled, defense counsel says, I still would like a motion or ruling on my motion for variance. And the court said, well, for all those various reasons I gave before, it's denied. Although there weren't very many reasons that were given before.
What about the jury instruction issue?
Okay, just a second. Okay, the jury instruction issue, Your Honor, is that the bottom line is that self-defense instruction that was given was still misleading and unclear to Mr. Yang's detriment. And what I see in looking at this and looking at this over and over again is that the state of mind with which the defendant acted in self-defense is critical, as critical in determining his guilt of the offense charged. So really, a jury has to make two separate determinations of a defendant's state of mind. One would be the state of mind with which he acted, say in this case, the hit, okay, against the wife. And then the second is his state of mind with respect to whether his level of awareness that his use of force was not immediately necessary to protect himself or other people. That is the reasonableness. And so there really are two separate states of mind with respect to self-defense. And I think to try to make things simpler for the jury, we try to cut the words down as much as possible. And so we have these words, which are defined, and I submit they are in there as defined words, that intent believes, intent, knowledge, and recklessness, they were defined. But I think because of this sort of dual determination of states of mind, that the court should have fashioned something to the effect of, in order to negate the justification of self-defense or defense of others and to convict Mr. Yang of abuse, the state must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he used force against Hana either A, with awareness, belief, or hope that his use of force was not immediately necessary. With awareness, that would be knowing that his use of force was not immediately necessary, or C, in conscious disregard of a substantial and unjustifiable risk that his use of force was not immediately necessary. I don't think there are so many negatives in there that I know that for just regular people to have to keep turning yourself around, to say, okay, negative, and then you negative that again, that's a double negative, and then there's a third negative, that it's very confusing, extremely confusing. Moreover,
is it fair to say that, again, trying to understand the practical effect of the defendant's position, and I thought this was the argument that the state was making, and if I'm mischaracterizing it, they can correct me, was that the defendant would get a self-defense instruction as long as the state of mind on the primary, on the offense itself, was intentional or knowing. So it seems like it almost, I think they're characterizing or suggesting that your approach would, in essence, obviate that second inquiry in cases where the actual offense was conducted in a way that was intentional or knowing. And that seems contrary to what we said in Culkin. That's what I think their argument is. Can you respond to that?
Okay. I caught that at the very last minute. I agree that, as you said in Culkin, it says that even for a reckless offense, and in that case it was reckless manslaughter with a dangerous instrument, that self-defense is an available defense. So self-defense doesn't get
not always.
Pardon me?
Only under certain circumstances will, if you have a reckless state of mind, will self-defense not be available to you. It's not in all circumstances.
But there's that second, that's why I believe that there needs to be a second analysis of the defendant's state of mind with which he used the force. So separate from whether he committed the act with intent, knowing, or recklessness would be whether his belief was reasonable, whether his belief was objectively reasonable, and whether his use of force was done with a conscious object, knowing that it wasn't justifiable, or whether he was reckless in not finding out whether his use of force was justifiable. And it's in that latter situation where it's not, where he was reckless in finding out information, you know, about the situation, you know, that maybe he didn't need to use that kind of force. A reasonable person in that situation would have said no. Then self-defense is not available to him in that situation. So it doesn't ride necessarily, as I initially thought, on whether the charged offense is intentional, knowing, or reckless. Does that answer your question?
You think Culkin doesn't govern here?
This is reconcilable with Culkin in your current position?
In my current position, yes, absolutely. Because I think, again, the instructions did not really make it clear to the jury what it was that they had to do. I was thinking of ways that we could remedy this, which it would be maybe asking the jury, special interrogatories as to, you know, what state of mind did you find that Mr. Yang acted with in committing the offense? Okay, and frankly, by even Mr. Yang's omission at trial, he did hit his wife when they were driving down the freeway, yes. Okay, so I would say intentional would be established on that basis. Then you go to the secondary determination of state of mind, which would be, did he consciously disregard a substantial and unjustifiable risk that it wasn't necessary to use that kind of force? And I would say the answer is no. He was not intentional, knowing, or reckless with regard to the way he used force. He had to make a split-second decision while the car is rolling in the midst of this argument as they're making the turn. As a driver, he's aware that there's, you know, cars waiting for him to make that left turn, that, you know, there are other people around, and that his car, the two occupants inside, himself and his wife, could have been injured as well as other people. So there is a self-defense or defense of others argument to both. But I think that the manner in which the instructions were given to the jury did not clarify for them what their job was, really.
Anything further at this time?
Well, Your Honor, hang on a second. I can just look at what I have, because, you know, if I may return back to the count 8 issue, first of all, I wanted to point out that of the cases that were cited, I'm asking this court to reaffirm what the Hawaii courts have already said in Staley, Territory versus Lowe, and Territory versus Crawford, which is a 1907 case, which is that although in general the precise time date of the commission of the offense is not a material element, if the time is of the essence of the offense, then it must be proved.
But weren't those cases talking about, you know, offenses that have to be proven at night, or, you know, like if you're sleeping in a park and you're there after 10 p.m., and isn't that what the focus of that?
That was one of the cases. Staley was actually a Theft 1 case where a man was living in using his brother's Section 8 benefits, living in the house that was provided to his brother. And so that was a little bit different. Territory versus Lowe and Territory versus Crawford were sex abuse cases against minors way back in 1939 and before 1907. I think it was in 1906. And in researching the case law with respect to time being of the essence, it's clear that there's two stripes of cases. One says that in cases involving sex abuse, particularly against minors, sexual assaults, the time, you know, can be alleged in a broad range, and you don't have to pin it down to a particular day and prove that particular day. So that's not available for that kind of a case. But on other cases, although time is not of the essence, generally speaking, if you can make it of the essence by submitting an alibi, notice of alibi, and that's where Quillen and Jennings and the Pennsylvania Superior Court and Boyer said that, you know, once the state responds in a notice of alibi, they need to prove what they notice in that alibi.
Well, I guess, Mr. Yanaka, I guess that's what I will, and follow up to Justice McKenna's question. Mm-hmm. If this isn't really an alibi case, are the remedies available to you under the notice of alibi still available to you? And is, does the state have to have the same ramifications for failure to meet up on the time?
I believe
if it's not an alibi case.
Well, first of all, my position is, and again, I haven't read that the Gabrillo case, that it is still a valid alibi defense, alibi notice alibi valid defense, and under those circumstances, that yes, the state having said we're going to prove, you know, April 7th of 2010, 6:37 p.m., and our complainant is our witness for that. So you know, if you want to talk to her and see if there's any different dates or times or something, you know, this is, we're noticing you as to who's going to testify to this to establish this particular evidence. We would submit that binds the state, because otherwise defendant doesn't have a defense. I mean, it's this, you know, slippy slidey thing. So she comes in, she says now it's 4 to 5. The next time she comes in, so for example, if there's a mistrial and a new trial on that, and we're now prepared for 4 to 5 all the way to 7 o'clock, and she says, oh, now it's 2 to 3. I mean, it's unfair to the defendant, because you know, the playing field is uneven. If the complainant keeps moving the goalpost, it's a violation of his due process, and it's a violation of the right to a fair trial. I see that my time is almost up, so I'm going to sit down if there are no further questions and reserve the rest for rebuttal.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hironaka. Mr. Vincent. Good afternoon.
I just want to point out that one thing wasn't mentioned during the previous presentation.
Oh, could you reset the light, please? I'm sorry. Thank you.
On page 43, there was actually an alibi instruction. It said, the state has the burden of establishing beyond a reasonable doubt the defendant's present at these times and places. That's required to, among other counts, count 8 of the charge, which is the alibi, when the alibi defense was alleged to. If after consideration of the evidence in this case, you have a reasonable doubt as to whether the defendant was present at the time the crime was committed, you must find the defendant not guilty. So I'm just wondering what the, it seems like they were instructed, whether that's a proper instruction or not, I don't know. They were instructed that it must have happened, I guess, sometime between 3 and 8, and they found that it happened at that time. This came to the biggest surprise of the state as it did to the...
Right. Didn't the state actually concede in closing that he had failed to prove the count?
Yeah.
And the jury still came back guilty?
That's correct. I guess the jury didn't accept that. So,
Mr. Vincent, I'd like to follow up, because that is a special concern I think I have in this case. And I think the government, when I looked at the direct examination of that witness... and I have it somewhere, but it was obvious that the prosecutor was also taken by complete surprise.
Right.
Because the prosecutor started, when the answer came out, the prosecutor said, you know, something like, are you sure, or is that the right time, or something like that.
I think
that.
Defense counsel said, can you repeat that, I think.
Yeah. So the prosecutor was obviously taken aback by the response completely. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the prosecutor, I think, really was, you know, really... was responsible in the situation by saying, look, and when you read what the prosecutor said, you know, it says, but you did, okay, so on the last count, you know, she said that it happened in the evening, that the defendant kicked her, but you did hear from the sergeant the defendant was working special duty. So, you know, in that situation, you know, maybe Mr. and Ms. Yang had the day wrong. I'm not sure, but it seems like the defendant was not at home at the time. Ms. Yang said that he was at home. So the state would concede that charge. You know, the state has not proven that charge beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, okay, and so the state concedes it. And then this is what, especially, the defense does their closing. And the defense, of course, has an enormous amount that it could argue because of all the conflicts, because, of course, you know, what she had testified in the first trial.
Telephone calls, too.
Yes, all exactly, the 20 phone calls. So there's a ton of stuff. But what the defense says... it goes through the counts, and the defense stands up and said, count 7, state conceded to you, they didn't prove it, you got records, you got the sergeant, he wasn't there, and then That's it. And because the state, the defense...
I think they meant count eight, but because it was...
Yeah, right. So the defense chooses, of course, not to argue based on the state's concession. Mm-hmm. And then, in the rebuttal, once again, the state is, you know, acknowledges it again and talks about... talking about the cases and says it kind of indirectly, and then we submit to you on the terrorist, and then this is the strongest case, so it kind of pushes off the other cases. So my question to you is, how does this comport with due process? How did the defendant get a fair trial when the state concedes the charge, the defense elects not to argue it based on the state's concession, the state reaffirms it, saying, you know, this, and directs the jury's attention to another one. Doesn't that violate the very fundamentals of getting a fair trial? That the defense has been basically told, we're conceding, I'm not going to argue this case, this case is, and then all of a sudden it comes back on a conviction? I mean, how can that be?
Yeah, that's surprising. I don't think it was unfair to continue the trial and allow the jury to deliberate in that, and provided the correct arguments were made by the defense, because at the time when the defense became aware of this discrepancy, okay, they had another week before their next trial day. They could have brought in another alibi witness.
I'm not asking you that. I understand. Yeah. My argument is argument in a sense. Yeah, a little bit is. What I'm troubled by is how we can conclude that the defendant got a fair trial when the government concedes and the defendant counsel doesn't proceed with their argument, and it goes to the jury that way.
Well, if I mean, I don't really have anything to add on that.
The state is not... Even though the state at trial conceded count eight, you're not conceding it on appeal. Is that your position?
I'm not conceding it on appeal, but I would say that if you are going to find an error, that you would just vacate that particular charge and give us a chance to proceed on it against, you know, in a new trial.
So. I guess you're in a tough position because what argument of counsel is not evidence.
That's true.
And the jury gets
evidence.
To take a look at the woman and decide. Whatever, decided.
And thought that it happened at a different time. Yeah. Or it's possible they believe they didn't believe it was alibi witnesses. That's possible.
Oh, that's true, too.
Yeah,
but you conceded. You conceded, and they have the records. And the records were...
We conceded that we didn't, I guess we didn't prove a beyond a reasonable doubt, I guess. Anyway, I really have to add on that. With respect to the... self-defense instruction. I think that the most important part of the self-defense instruction is the first sentence in the second paragraph. It's on page 44 of the jury instructions. It says, the use of force upon or toward another person is justified if the defendant reasonably believes that force is immediately necessary to protect himself on the present occasion. And that is paralleled also in the defense of others thing. So basically, it explains to the jury that it's a reasonable belief. It's an objective, reasonable man standard, not a subjective, I believe it was necessary standard. And I don't think you can have a reckless belief that you're justified in using self-defense and still meet the reasonable man standard. So. To some extent,
you got to change that to person, okay?
Pardon?
You got to change that to person.
Person, sorry. Okay, that's right.
Hope I'm reasonable.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I guess what I'm saying is that the last three paragraphs, I think that the language based on Penal Code 703.310 is not really necessary, because I think it's all said in that sentence there. A reasonable man standard doesn't comport with a reckless. A state of mind. Okay. So.
Well, isn't there a sliver of difference? I would think if you negligently appraised the circumstances, if you negligently appraised it and you acted based on that, you could still be acting reasonably. There might be a slight, they don't necessarily, it seems to me, coincide exactly, those two provisions.
But it has to be, the jury has to make a factual determination that he actually saw things as he saw them, essentially. So I don't think that it's really a problem. I think really the reasonable person standard only kicks in once the jury finds how he viewed the circumstances that he was in at the time. In this case, I guess, the facts are that he was driving and she was trying to grab, allegedly she was trying to grab the steering wheel. As he admits he hit her in the arm three or four times. She says he hit her in the head, but he says it only in the arm. And he did it to keep, I guess, to protect himself and other drivers in the road from injury. That's his contention. Okay. I think that the jury made a finding of fact as to whether or not she actually grabbed the steering wheel, whether or not she was capable of causing an accident, whether or not, and then I think they had to decide whether or not his reaction in that circumstance was that of a reasonable person. And it couldn't be done in a reckless manner.
My understanding is that the defense is not actually arguing these instructions are incorrect.
That's correct.
Yeah. I think all they're asking, and they made no request at trial, mm-hmm. was that it should be clear, but the instruction specifically starts out, self-defense or defense of others, both of them, is not available in such circumstances. So the instruction perhaps could be clearer, but it's not technically wrong.
That's correct. I think as a whole, it's taken in totality, it's a fair, accurate statement of the law. It's not misleading. Any further questions?
Nothing further, thank you. Ms. Hiranaka, any rebuttal?
Just briefly. The one point that I wanted to rebut that counsel made was that they said that with respect to count 8 and, that the fact that the state conceded at closing argument that it hadn't been established, that the case should then be sent back for retrial. We vehemently oppose that, and we submit that if there was insufficient evidence, of course it should be just a straight-out reversal, and that should be the end of that. And that's really the only rebuttal that I have. If the court has any further questions, I'll stay, of course, but if not, I would close by asking again the court to vacate his conviction, Mr. Yang's conviction in count 6. I do understand that the remedy for that is a new trial in count 6 with proper jury instructions, but to vacate and reverse the conviction in count 8, period. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you to both of our counsel. The court will take this matter under advisement.
Please rise. Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii.